this is pretty good.
While people are drifting in, one of the things that I have learned over the course of doing these seminars is, independent of how far behind I get, and I'm already behind, pausing after every break to see if people have comments or questions is worth the time. So if anybody who has a comment or a question, based on what got said in the first segment, or based on what got said during the break, feel free to raise it.
You're taking a taxi.
Yes. You can talk very loud because you're competing with the noise from the panel.
There were four of us, and it was $10 a piece, including tax.
Yes.
Or tip, rather.
I'm going to stay for the whole time.
Oh, that's right,
because
you're here.
I'm going to drive, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But I got to go to the airport to pick up my car.
I would say yes and no. I mean, I have been in places where, including, nuclear weapons facilities, most particularly Rocky Flats, where they actually managed the outrage down close enough to zero that the problem went away. Hanford, the problem has still not gone away. I think they've got it chronic rather than acute. I think it's in better control than it was in the early years. But it's a half a success story and half a failure story. Other comments or questions? Yes. I would love to, but is there anyone here who has control over the heat or knows how to control the heat? David, okay. David's got it under control. I should have known that you guys were cold because I'm comfortable, and you're sitting and I'm walking around, and I have adrenaline coursing through my system, and you're trying to stay awake. It's like surgeons and patients want different temperatures, and speakers and audiences want different temperatures. But David, you have successfully made it warmer. So help is on the way. Other comments? Yes?
When you were talking about great management of subsidy, it reminded me of we had a school health situation where people were upset about environmental health situations in schools and fearing that they were causing teachers and people to be sick. And we had a series of meetings, and by the last meeting, it was down to the four or five just come to every meeting, hardcore, want to be heard, I hope. And so we felt like we were doing pretty well, but at the very last meeting we were accused of that it was our fault that more people weren't at the last meeting because people had to be outraged, so therefore we had done a bad job because there had to be more outraged people than the five that so it was our fault that more outraged people were not coming to the meeting. So I think we had but in a weird way, we were still still outraged being protected.
Well, yeah, but that's as good as it gets. You've got five sour grapes bitching and moaning that because you did better outrage management than they did precaution advocacy, they're now, the reporters aren't in the room anymore, and the audience isn't in the room anymore, and they've lost their constituency, and they're, and all they can think of to say is it must somehow be your fault. If every time I consulted in outrage management I could get that conclusion, I would be an extremely successful consultant. That's about as good as it gets. Other comments? Okay, let me quickly introduce the three games, and then we'll talk some about precaution advocacy. The first game, those of you who are following along in the handouts, we're up to the page on the seesaw. The seesaw is the third game that I want to say something briefly about the other two, which is not in the handouts. The first game that I want to talk about for a minute is follow the leader. Follow the leader is the game you play when you're talking to somebody with no prior opinion. That zero stands for no prior opinion. You want to convince me of X. And I have no opinion on the subject. I don't believe X. I don't disbelieve X. I have no opinion. How do you convince people with no opinion that they ought to believe X? Very simple. You tell them X. Okay? People with no opinion, it's very easy to replace no opinion with a weakly held opinion on your side. You just say X, X is true, you give a couple of examples, you use a third party endorsement, maybe you give a little data, but it's a piece of cake. People will follow the leader if they have no opinion. Very quickly, just to make sure you've got something this morning, in which of the three kinds of risk communication is follow the leader likeliest to be the game you're playing? Precaution advocacy. In precaution advocacy, you're usually talking to people with no opinion. It's hard to get their attention. If you get their attention, it is not hard to convince them that you're right. They haven't got any competing opinion standing in the way. The second game is donkey. Donkey is the game you play when you're talking to somebody with one opinion, and it is, as far as you're concerned, the wrong opinion. I believe Y, and you want me to believe X. What happens if you play follow the leader in a donkey environment? You got a room full of people who believe Y, and you say X. What do I say back?
Y.
And you say no, X. And
why?
I say no, Y. And you say X, X, X. And I say Y, Y. And you say X, you idiot. And I say Y, you asshole. What have you done? Polarize the issue. You've increased the outrage. You've given people an opportunity to rehearse how deeply committed they are to Y. It's not just that it didn't work. You have made the situation worse. If you're in a donkey environment, you need to play donkey. Now, playing donkey happens in two stages. In the first stage, you validate my belief in why. Now, you don't want to validate the truth of why, because your entire point is that why isn't true, X is true. So you don't want to say why is true. How do you validate my belief in why without actually validating why?
I see that you care very much about this.
I see that you care very much about this. That'll do it. What are some others? A lot of people in this room probably believe why. I used to believe why before I came to work to the health department and they sent me to re-education camp. Why is in the media all the time. My mother taught me why and still believes it. There was an example of why just last week. Why is the common sense answer. The burden of proof is on those of us who believe X. All of those statements have the structure of validating my belief in why without validating the truth of why. Okay? You're telling me I'm not stupid to believe why. I can't tell you how important it is to tell people they are not stupid to think that cell phones are dangerous, or they're not stupid to think that the pandemic vaccine is dangerous. You can't persuade people who think you think they're stupid. So you have to validate my belief in why. Then you get to part two. Having validated my belief in why, now you take me on a journey from Y to X. You drop breadcrumbs on the road from Y to X. Now those breadcrumbs may be data, they may be experiential, you're taking on a field trip, they may be third-party endorsements, they may be emotional statements of one sort or another. Well, you have all kinds of rhetorical tools available to you. The point is, your topic is not why. Your topic is the journey from Y to X. And you're only doing that after you have validated my belief. Journey from Y to X. The topic is not X, it's the journey from Y to X. And you can only do that after validating that my belief in Y is not stupid. Everybody understand donkey? Now, I said that if you play follow the leader in a donkey environment, it's going to backfire. What happens if you play donkey in a follow the leader environment? It's going to backfire. You walk into a room full of people who have no opinion, and you say, a lot of people in this room probably believe Y. I used to believe Y. Y is common sense. The burden of proof is on those of us who believe X. What have you done? You've created a donkey. Everybody see that? So you really need to know, are you playing? playing follow the leader or are you playing donkey? And if you're playing both at the same time, you know, it would be nice to get them separated. All donkeys go to room 6. And if you can't separate them, then you're going to have to figure out which audience matters more to you. The audience of people who have no opinion, who you can easily seduce into a weak opinion on your side, or the audience of people who disagree with you, where it is difficult but not impossible if you do it right to change their mind. Okay. The answer to that question is not obvious. You have to figure out which one you care about more. You know, winning over your enemy or the much easier pickings of getting a weak commitment on your side for people who have no prior. The third game is by far the most interesting, and that's Seesaw. Seesaw is the game you're playing when you're talking to somebody with two opinions. I believe X and Y at the same time. That's not because I'm schizophrenic, it's because I'm ambivalent. I am torn. On the one hand, I'm worried about swine flu, and I think I should get my vaccine. On the other hand, I'm worried that it's a new vaccine, and it might hurt me. So I am ambivalent. Here's the rule of the seesaw. Whenever people are ambivalent, people are not always ambivalent, but whenever people are ambivalent, they go to the side of their ambivalence that is inadequately represented in their communication environment. There it is as an abstract principle. Let me say it more concretely. If I believe X and Y at the same time, then if you tell me X, I will say no Y. If you tell me Y, I will say no X. Those are
I should tell the opposite of what I want.
Yeah, well, that's where we're going. That's where we're going. Those of you who have raised teenagers are very familiar with this story. Because teenagers are ambivalent about almost everything, you know. And if you say, I like your new boyfriend or I like your new girlfriend, they'll probably break up. If you say, I hate them, they'll probably live together. Why did the kids put beans in their ears? And it's a very familiar phenomenon. We call it, you know, people who don't want to call it the seesaw call it reverse psychology. Not everybody is ambivalent all the time the way teenagers are, but people are often ambivalent in risk situations, particularly in crisis situations. But in many kinds of risk situations, people may be ambivalent. Let me give you the classic example or the classic study of a risk seesaw, and that is the low probability, high magnitude, worst case scenario. That, yes, it's a worst case scenario has two characteristics. It's bloody unlikely and it's really horrible. And those are not incompatible with each other. You know, horrible things are usually unlikely. But they're emotionally incompatible. The lesson of unlikely is don't worry about it. The lesson of horrible is take precautions. And people have a very hard time thinking simultaneously about low probability and high magnitude. They tend to focus on one and ignore the other. And the one they focus on will be the one you ignore. So, there is in the United States a regulation called RMP. It stands for Risk Management Plan. It requires companies that use or manufacture hazardous chemicals to calculate the worst case scenario for their use of those chemicals. How could the plant kill the largest number of its neighbors? And then once a year, they have to bring the neighbors in for a coffee clutch to talk about the worst case scenario. This has been law for a long time. It covers thousands of facilities. So we have tens of thousands of examples and a data set of these kinds of conversations. And here's what we've learned. It follows the principle of this is so very, very well. Here's what we've learned. If you're a typical plant manager, you'll walk into this situation. Let me give a good example first, okay? If you've been properly trained, you'll walk into this situation and you'll say, look, if this happens, and this happens, and this happens, and this happens, look how many people we could kill.
pass out.
Yeah.
Plume maps. And the plume maps have LD50s on them. LD50 is the area of the map where half the population will live. And if you do it, within about 30 seconds, somebody raises his or her hand and says, well, yeah, but isn't that really unlikely? And then you say, yes, it is. It's really, it's extremely unlikely. But look how many people we could kill. And if you stay focused on the high magnitude of your worst case scenario for the first half hour of the meeting, by the end of that half hour, the entire room has united behind the principle that you should grow up. And stop wasting our time on this exceedingly unlikely worst-case scenario. And all future dialogue with that community focuses on higher probability, lower magnitude, smaller accidents. If, on the other hand, you weren't trained, or you thought the training was stupid, you couldn't believe it, and you're the typical plant manager, you'll walk into the room, same audience, and you'll say something like this. We're here this evening to discuss our worst-case scenario, and we're going to do that because there's a regulation that requires us to do that, and here at the XYZ Corporation, we obey all regulations, even really stupid ones. But I have to tell you, this is an exceedingly stupid regulation. Our worst-case scenario is so bloody unlikely, it's not worth worrying about. Don't give it a second thought. We certainly don't. If that's your message, and you can't tell people not to worry about something without strongly implying that you are not worried about it. If that's your message, then by the end of the first half hour, the room has united behind a different principle that you should be forced to spend whatever it takes to reduce this 1 in a million risk to zero. If you're focused on how horrific it is, they will focus on how unlikely it is. If you're focused on how unlikely it is, they will focus on how horrific it is. Now, does that always happen? No, only if they're ambivalent. If they're in your back pocket, they're going to focus on how unlikely it is regardless. If they are a dedicated opponent, they're going to focus on how horrific it is regardless. But if they're ambivalent, if they're torn, then if you pay insufficient attention to one side, that's the side of their ambivalence they will go to. They will go to the side you seem to be neglecting. You resolve their ambivalence by standing in for them on half of their ambivalence, and then they can stand tall for the other half. So if you think the game is follow the leader, and it's actually seesaw, you will preempt the seat on the seesaw you want them to take in your effort to lead them to it. Does this make sense yet? Well, you're nodding your head, but you're creasing your brows.
Okay, so how do you know? I know, you're going to fill me in on the survey, but how do you know whether it's a seesaw or a follow the leader?
You can usually, assuming you don't do a survey, as, you know, or even like some, you know, call a few people and chat with them about it and get a sense of it, you can usually probe. You know, the easiest way to probe for a seesaw is, you know, say X and see if they say Y back at you, and if they do, say something Y-ish and see if they say X back at you. And if they keep sounding oppositional, if they keep taking whatever side you didn't take, you know they're on the seesaw. And then you can manage the seesaw thereafter, knowing that that's the game you're playing. So if you don't know walking into the room, you can probe. If it's not a room and, you know, it's a mass media message, then you're going to have to know, or you're going to have to guess, or you're going to have to design, you know, as best you can, multi-purpose messages. It is easier to combine seesaw with donkey than it is to combine seesaw with follow the leader. Let me give you one more, maybe two more seesaw examples, and then we'll start on precaution advocacy. Another seesaw, very, very common in risk communication, is forgiveness. Apologies and forgiveness are often on the seesaw. That is, the sorrier you are, the more I forgive you. The more you forgive yourself and are not very sorry, the more I blame you. One quick example of that. Do you remember the Jack-in-the-Box food poisoning?
Yeah.
It was E. coli 0157H7, a particularly virulent strain of E. coli. Two things went wrong. The supplier delivered to Jack in the Box meat that was very contaminated with this virulent strain of E. coli. And the second thing that went wrong is Jack in the Box didn't cook the meat enough. If the
meat had been thoroughly cooked, it wouldn't have mattered that it was contaminated. If the meat hadn't been so contaminated, it wouldn't have mattered that it wasn't thoroughly cooked. It took two culpable errors to produce a catastrophe. Well, if you think it's a catastrophe, I think it is. Four kids died, dozens of kids needed transplants, kidney transplants, hundreds of kids were hospitalized. Pretty serious, pretty big deal. On day one of the crisis, kids are still streaming into the hospital. The CEO of Foodmaker, the company that owns Jack in the Box, held a news conference. And at the news conference, he said, "Look, we are as much the victims here as these children. Our supplier delivered to us meat that was contaminated with E. coli. It says right here in our contract that they must deliver meat that's fit for human consumption. They are in violation of the contract, and we filed suit against them this morning for $200 million. On the same day, the CEO of didn't tell the news conference, but he did issue a statement. And the statement began, this is a direct quote, the statement began, "This is the worst thing our company has ever done." Not the worst thing that has ever happened to our company. That's what Exxon said after Valdez. "This is the worst thing our company has ever done. We knew about E. coli. And we had what we thought was a pretty good screening program for E. coli, but that screening program wasn't sensitive enough for this new virulent strain. We'd heard about the virulent strain, and we were in process of thinking through an upgrade of our screening program, but because we were asleep at the switch, because we were too slow to move, four kids are dying, hundreds of kids are hospitalized, and we feel horrible." Now you have to know, it was not easy to persuade their lawyers to let them say that. And our argument to the lawyers was, look, everything except "we feel horrible" in that statement is already known. It's not only that it's discoverable, the public has already heard it from the health department. You know, it's all known already. The only thing the public doesn't know is that you're willing to blame yourself. Okay? That you know you have sinned. That's the only thing the public doesn't know. So if you're going to be admitting it in lawsuits over the next several years, let us admit it in the newspaper tomorrow morning. We had to convince the lawyers. We also had to convince the insurance company, because as some of you know, lots of insurance policies provide that if you admit liability without the insurance company's okay, your insurance is void, which is a big deal. And we convinced the lawyers, convinced the insurance company. Here's the bottom line. Jack in the Box blamed the supplier. The supplier blamed the supplier. The public blamed Jack in the Box. The only difference is the CSUN. They were equally guilty. You know, legally and morally, they were equally culpable. They were equally vulnerable. I'm not telling you the name of the supplier, because that was my client. You can find out, just Google the Jack in the Box crisis. They'll show up in about the ninth paragraph. But not the first few paragraphs. It's the Jack in the Box crisis. And it's not because they were the supplier. You know, when you look at Firestone Tires, the supplier took a hit. When you look at any number of food recalls, Hudson Food went bankrupt. They were the supplier. And the retailer did okay. Who gets the blame from the public is not a function of who deserves the blame, it's a function of who rejects the blame. And whoever refuses to take the blame gets blamed. Whoever is willing to take the blame gets forgiven. Do you see the seesaw? Yes?
So I
want to
help you out with your radiological.
Oh, thank you!
Because thank God I actually read your column on the seesaw a couple of years ago before nuclear power plant exercise at Indian Point. Now, for those of you who aren't aware, that's a nuclear power plant that's just upwind of New York City. There's a lot of controversy. So in these exercises, they always try to make them just as dramatic as possible. And the goal is to get the information out really quickly. But just because, you know, when you're in exercise land, events
nail yourself to the wall before they get a chance to nail you to the wall. Now, often health departments don't do that. Their political leaders won't let them do it. Sometimes their sense of professionalism won't let them do it. I worked with CDC on anthrax, and I know personally, what was the big technical mistake CDC made in the anthrax outbreak? And because they thought that they didn't realize that weaponized anthrax is different, they assured the Postal Service that as long as the envelope is sealed, no problem. Okay? And by the time they realized that that was not true, several postal workers were dying, and two huge postal facilities, including mine in central New Jersey, were contaminated. And, you know, Julie Gerberding, then head of the Infectious Disease Branch, later head of the CDC, and now gratefully retired. She was in charge of that. It was her people and her mistake, you know, and she felt horrible about it. And, you know, I mean, if you imagine how awful you feel if you devoted your life to public health and you made a mistake that killed people, you know? She felt awful. She also felt it would be unprofessional to say she felt awful. And she, you know, she kept saying to me, you know, no, our message to them, you know, has to be, let's put that behind us, let's move forward. And I said, no, let's put that behind us is their job. That's their line. Okay, you should look steadfastly backwards until the Postal Service people say, all right, let's put that behind us, let's move on, let's decide whether we want, you know, Cipro or doxycycline or, you know, whatever the other issues are going to be. But nobody's ain't going to put that behind them until you have well running. It took me weeks to convince Dr. Gerberding and others at CDC that was the right strategy. And ultimately, they did begin to make apology and, you know, a core message. And within minutes of it happened in a lot of different meetings, but in any single meeting, within minutes of saying, wow, we made this horrible mistake when, you know, we just didn't realize that weaponized anthrax, you know, could escape through sealed envelopes, and feel so awful about that mistake. In minutes, if any time you said that, somebody from the Postal Service, you know, or from the Postal Union would say, all right, let's put that behind us. You know, we understand you made a mistake, let's move on. And then once again, a seesaw. Okay, we're now done with the session that was supposed to end half an hour ago. And I want to talk some about, God, I have all these radiation examples and I'm not taking the time for it. I want to talk some about precaution advocacy, a little bit more detail on precaution advocacy. If you look in the handouts, you should find a list, you know, entitled Watch Out, a list of a whole bunch of precaution advocacy strategies, rules of precaution advocacy, and make sure that that's actually there. There it is, page 15. I'm going to talk my way through some of these, and I won't get to all of them, but I'll talk through some of them. And maybe along the way I'll have a chance to say something about radiation. Okay. And I should start even before I get to this list by saying, you know, when, you know, I said earlier that precaution advocacy is for when people are apathetic. You need to be aware of the fact that sometimes when people seem to be apathetic, they're not. What can look like apathy that isn't apathy?
Denial,
okay, is a biggie. What's the difference between denial and apathy?
People are
claiming not to be upset because they're not upset. People in denial are claiming not to be upset because they're too upset to bear, and they've shut down emotionally. As a practical matter, if you scare people who are apathetic, they get less apathetic. If you scare people who are in denial, they get more into denial. And to preempt your question, that's how you tell if you don't know. you know, say something scary, and if it backfires, they were in denial. Now, denial is the zebra, apathy is the horse. I mean, most of the time, when people look apathetic, they are. But sometimes when people look apathetic, they are in denial, and there's an obvious nuclear example. I grew up in an era of very high denial about nuclear war. And because we were in denial about nuclear war, we really liked the Peter Strangelove movie, the Peter Sellers movie about Dr. Strangelove. We believed that it was sound policy that if there's a nuclear war, the only useful thing to do is get over and kiss your ass goodbye. We thought fallout shelters were stupid. We were wrong on all counts about all of that. Now that I know some of the data, it was very clear that the things my people my age did in junior high school, where we got under the desk and practiced duck and cover, that's actually a very sound strategy. If the new kid's right where you are, it's not going to help any. But if the new kid's 20 or 30 miles away, what you're mostly worried about is flying glass and being blinded by the radiation ball, and duck and cover is going to protect you from those two and give you time to get to someplace safer. So anyway, denial was what was going on. And when people didn't understand denial was what was going on, Helen Caldicott, for example, how many of you know who she is? Very few of you. Helen Caldicott was an anti-nuclear activist. I think she's still around, but she was most active in the 1980s and 1990s. And she used to do what her allies called her bombing runs, where she would go talk to an audience like this, and she was talking about, she opposed nuclear weapons. And she would say, if the nuclear bomb were to fall, were to explode right here, right now, here's what would happen. And she had an early computer model that would enable her to talk about, how many doctors would survive and how many would die, and within what radius people would be incinerated and within what radius they would live to suffer. And she'd have the whole thing with melting eyeballs. She's a very, very graphic, wonderful speaker. And every time she did it, maybe 10% of the audience was inspired to become anti-nuclear activists. And the other 90% of the audience was pushed more deeply into denial and walked out of that room determined never again to think about nuclear war. So it was a great recruiting tool, but it was not a good persuasion tool because people were in denial. Are you with me? Another thing that might masquerade as apathy that isn't apathy is problems of self-efficacy. People who feel like they don't know what to do are likely to tell themselves they don't care. And they are likely to tell you they don't care. When I was doing work on RIDA, and the question was, how do we persuade people to test their homes for radon? A lot of apathy about radon, no question about it. But also, a lot of people who weren't so apathetic were convinced that they better be apathetic because they thought they didn't know how to test for radon. And it turns out testing for radon is roughly as difficult as flushing the toilet. I mean, it's not really a high-tech thing to do. And the instructions are on the can. But people didn't know that. And you knocked on their door and you said, I'm here to urge you to test for radon. And, radon is a decay product of uranium in soil. Why is this through the rocks and soil? If it's the surface on your home, it's going to give you cancer, blah, 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 blah. And you said that, and people got the impression, oh, God, test my home for radon. I wasn't good in science in high school. I bet you need a Bunsen burner. In the research that we did, we found that, a high priority reason for declining to test underneath the I'm not worried about radon was I'm worried that I'll screw up the test. And that's quite common. That's quite common. It comes up all the time in safety work I do, that employees who don't know how to use the safety equipment, or even who do know how to use the safety equipment, but think they don't know how to use the safety equipment, they're not confident of their ability to use the safety equipment, will, especially if they're male, refuse to use the safety equipment. They won't say, I don't know how. They'll say, it's stupid to worry about. You don't want to always assume that if it looks like apathy, it's apathy. But if it is apathy, then These strategies are, you know, are the core of what you do. And I'm just going to cruise through, skip some, and talk about some. Talked enough about keeping it short, making it interesting, and staying on message. Number four is to test your messages. And let me say as clearly as I know how, you know, in crisis communication, you may not have time to test. In outrage management, you may not have time to test. In precaution advocacy, you know, it's a slog. It's a long-term process. You have time to test. There's very little excuse in precaution advocacy for not testing your messages. If you've got the cash and the expertise to do careful, methodologically sound testing, fine, do that. If you have to do sloppy testing, I'm a big believer in sloppy research. I think sloppy research is enormously better than no research. At least ask your daughter and your mother what they think of your message. And try and get some testing before you move forward. It's very hard to do in the other two kinds of risk communication because time is tight. But in caution advocacy, time is not tight. You know, you're working on problems that take forever. Which brings me to number five, plan for a slog. Precaution advocacy is a slog. The rule of thumb is it takes a generation for a successful precaution advocacy campaign to work. Whether that's seatbelts or smoke alarms, and you know, I mean, you think of things, you know, things that have become the norm that used to be really weird. And the ones that worked took a generation. Now sometimes you work on it for a generation and you don't get there. But it's very rare for precaution advocacy on a big issue to succeed in less than a generation. Now, sometimes precaution advocacy turns into crisis communication, and then it can succeed overnight. But yeah, in April of 2001, I attended a conference on how to make Americans more worried about terrorism. It was funded by the CIA and the FBI and a bunch of other agencies that if I told you who they are, I'd have to kill you. And it was a three-day conference on how do we do terrorism precaution advocacy. You know, and we worked on it, and we came up with some suggestions, and you know, the report of that meeting was distributed to the participants a couple of weeks before 9/11. And 9/11 solved the problem. It's high collateral cost, but it went from precaution advocacy to crisis communication, and the problem, the attack of 9/11 did the job that we were trying to do without having an attack. Sometimes God or Al Qaeda intervenes, and your precaution advocacy isn't needed anymore. But if it stays precaution advocacy, it will probably take a generation. So pace yourself. Yes.
That example, interesting example there, because it sounds as if the at least the agencies that hired you to assess the problem were placing emphasis on how do we make the public aware, increase their concern. When apparently, from all reports, other mechanisms in the government were not operating efficiently to exchange information that would have prevented the attack in the first place. So the question is, was there a emphasis on one approach when the emphasis should have been on the other approach?
Well, I suspect it's different people, but I take your point that it was higher priority to share information among these agencies than it was to convince the public that the issue was serious. But they were all starved for bucks. They were all terribly frustrated because, you'll remember, prior to 9/11, most Americans thought it can't happen here. You know, and they knew that it can happen here. And they wanted Americans to know that it can happen here so that Americans would support appropriate precautions and a variety of things they wanted us to do or let them do, where our
our complacency was getting in the way. So I don't think that was inappropriate, although I grant you that it was less important than some other things they weren't doing. A more interesting point, and the point I thought you were about to make, is, you know, many of the same agencies that tried to arouse outrage before 9/11 tried to reduce outrage after 9/11. And that's absolutely characteristic. I've watched, over the years with bird flu more than swine flu, where, in country after country after country, health agencies would say, it might get pandemic, it's going to be serious, we have to worry about it, we have to take this seriously, and then they have an outbreak. Not obviously a big human outbreak, because there haven't been big human bird flu outbreaks, but they'd have a big outbreak in birds. And suddenly they become incredibly worried about their poultry industry. And what should have been the teachable moment, what should have been the moment when your public is really paying attention for the first time to the possibility that bird flu is a serious risk, agencies, time after time after time, would piss away the teachable moment and stop doing precaution advocacy. The one moment when people are listening, they would stop doing precaution advocacy and start doing outrage management. Which I guess is itself a seesaw, right? Only it's not you using the seesaw, it's you getting seesawed. It's all these emergency managers who spend 30 years telling the city council we're not prepared until somebody says you're not prepared and they say we are too. which is dancing to somebody else's seesaw. I think that's a nice metaphor.
But you get
I think it was good that they tried to scare people. The point though that they tried to get us to figure out how to scare people. The point that I want to leave you with on number five is that it's a slog. And unless it turns into a crisis, it's going to stay a slog. One of the sort of corollaries of that is school programs are very, very worth doing. A lot of my clients say, teaching kids that, its payoff is so delayed. And that's not entirely true because, kids have a lot of influence on their parents. But even if it were true, given that it's going to take a generation anyhow, get those kids in school. Number six is appeal to needs. And I'm going to pause on this one and spend a little time on it. What time, in order to get back on schedule, what time would I have to turn to outrage management? Um, 1115. Okay, somebody tell me at 1115. Who's going to take that assignment? Okay, thank you. Here's persuasion theory in one sentence. Identify a need people already feel. Remind them of that need as forcefully as you can, and then tell them you have a way to satisfy that need. Let me say it again. Identify a need people already feel, remind them of that need as forcefully as you can, and then tell them you have a way to satisfy that need. The effectiveness of this kind of appeal to needs is proportional to the strength of the need and the strength of the message that connects the need to the behavior. It is not meaningfully related to the actual relevance of the behavior to the need in question. So, cigarette advertising used sex to sell cigarettes. Anybody have an idea about whether that worked? Yeah, that worked. But it didn't work cognitively. It's not like people said to themselves, oh, I get it. If I smoke, I'm likelier to get lucky. People kind of knew that smoking actually made them less successful sexually because they stank. Their experience was that smoking is not an aphrodisiac. But the messaging appealed to their sexual needs and linked their sexual needs to smoking. And the stronger their sexual needs, the more powerful the message was. It's not a cognitive message. The most vivid example of this is an experiment that has been done dozens of times. It's one of the favorite master's thesis topics because it always works. Here's what you do. You get a bunch of people, and some of them, they agree to be subjects in your experiment, and some of them are told they can't have anything to drink.
I don't mean alcohol, they can't have anything to drink for 12 hours before the experiment. The others are allowed to drink as they like. So half the group comes into the experiment thirsty, and the other group comes in not thirsty. And then you show them a movie, and halfway through the movie you have an intermission. Right before the intermission, you put on the screen a message: thirsty, eat popcorn. Not subliminal. It sits there on the screen. And people elbow each other and say, "Hey, this is the experiment right here. This is what they got us here for." Nothing happening subliminally. And then during the intermission, popcorn is available. Drinks are also available. And you measure how much people drink and how much popcorn they eat. And what do you think you get? People who were thirstier drink more. Because they're not stupid. They know that what you do when you're thirsty is drink. Okay. They also eat more popcorn. And you ask them, why did you eat more popcorn? And, I don't know. You know, why not? It's nothing. You know, if you ask them, do you think popcorn relieves thirst? They say, what are you, stupid? Of course popcorn doesn't relieve thirst. But they ate the popcorn anyway. And as I say, this has been done and redone and redone.